Hello, and welcome to Rabble Radio. It's Friday, December 17th, 2021. I'm your host and the editor of Rabble.ca, Chelsea Nash. Thanks so much for tuning in. Rabble breaks down the news of the day from a progressive lens. It's a good place to catch up and catch on to what's happening in Canadian politics, activism, the environment, and so much more. Listen to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. We catch you up on the news of the week and take you further into the stories that matter to you. This week on Rabble Radio, it is our last episode of 2021, and we're reflecting back on this year, highlighting the most newsworthy stories. And let me just say, there were plenty to choose from. 2021 presented a plethora of newsworthy moments for us here at Rabble to dive into. From environmental news to Indigenous justice to politics, as always, Rabble was there keeping you up to date on the current news as it happened this year. To begin, let's start on the Pacific side of Canada, all the way at Fairy Creek, British Columbia. This old growth forest in the southern portion of Vancouver Island has made headlines in the past year as it is the site of ongoing protests against old growth logging. In November, friend of the Rabble family, Libby Davies, interviewed climate activist and land defender Rita Wong. In this clip, Rita discusses her role at Fairy Creek and describes why the site has had such an impact on activists in BC and across the country. Take a listen.
A dear mentor of mine, Lee Maracle, I remember her saying that, you know, if you live on Coast Salish territory, you're a Coast Salish citizen and you have Coast Salish responsibilities. Even if you don't understand that and you haven't been taught what your responsibilities are, you have those responsibilities. If we center the land and the place that we live first, right, and then think about how we organize ourselves accordingly. You know, with regards to Fairy Creek, I have to say it has been absolutely amazing what I've witnessed up there, like the incredible people there at the invitation of Pachydat Elder Bill Jones and a number of other people in his community. It has been really hard to see the violence. And I was just actually the other day looking at this footage from, I think it was Monday, Paul Chioctin, he's from the Shanik First Nation. And he was basically telling the RCMP that he was there to protect their kids because they weren't capable of it themselves. And it really hit home for me. Like, when you think about, you know, your own little, small, humble life in the context of the many, many generations before you and the many generations to come, like, I think that long-term view is so important, especially right now, you know, as we see increasing climate destabilization, heat waves, forest fires. You know, I'm in my early 50s and I'm seeing things I never thought I would live to see in my lifetime, and it scares me. And I, you know, if it scares me, I can't imagine what it does to the young people. And that's why so many young people are up there at Fairy Creek, because it's their future, and they're not just their future, but their current lives that are at stake right now. Many of us go there with the hope that we can contribute to something, right? That to help protect what's left, what little is left, right? Less than 3% of the ancient forests. And when you're on the ground at Fairy Creek, you learn so much from the people who are there. About just being in community with one another. You also, I think, have to think about the systemic kind of challenges at play, the divide and conquer that colonialism has done to us as a whole, and the challenges of trying to heal that. And so, you know, there's a vision of people coming from all four directions, or there's a young woman up there named Rainbow Eyes, who, you know, thinks of us as the Rainbow Nation, of people coming from all directions, because now is the time that we need to do that. And so Fairy Creek really, you know, resonates with a lot of people.
That was Libby Davies in conversation with Rita Wong from our November 19th episode. If you're interested in learning more about Rita's experience in Fairy Creek, we recommend checking out our site. She has written several articles for us. You can type her name in the search bar there to hear more about her time spent at the Old Growth Forest and being a forest defender there. Keeping the conversation on environmental justice and Indigenous rights, this year, Rabble correspondent Brent Patterson kept us all up to date on the latest news in his coverage of the Wet'suwet'en territory. The protests concerning the construction of the Coastal GasLink pipeline through 190 kilometers of the unceded lands of the Wet'suwet'en First Nation territory have been ongoing ever since Wet'suwet'en hereditary chiefs opposed the project back in 2010. But it wasn't until last year, 2020, when action really started amping up. On our December 10th show, Brent sat down with sisters Eve Saint and Jossie Alec, two Indigenous land defenders who were both criminally charged in the last 2 years as they protected their traditional territory from the pipeline development. Here's a clip from that interview of Eve Saint detailing the day she was arrested.
The raids started happening with other camps. They raided Camp 39, and that camp was set up to bring us supplies, and we were behind a blockade. And so they started off entering 39, and then it kind of just tumbled from there. And then next thing you know, like, we don't know when they're coming or what they're going to do. And like Jossie said, because I can relate, like, you can't make any sudden movements, or else they will shoot you. Like, I was the police liaison. And also because it's my father's territory, that I wanted to be the one to talk with them and to let them know that that's Wasa's territory, and that we are under Wet'suwet'en law, and we have every right to be there. And so, like, I remember just being like, don't make any sudden movements. And my partner too stood with me, like, just like Jossie. And he was like, be careful how you point that feather in your hand. Cause I had an eagle feather, and an eagle feather, like, that is sacred to, like, Indigenous people. And I felt like, oh my God, I didn't even think about that, because I was pointing it at them. And then he's like, don't do that. Don't do that. They're going to shoot you. They're going to shoot you. And, like, unfortunately, like, I hate to say this, but I was pregnant at the time. And you know what? I didn't want to have to be there, but I had to, because there was just too much at stake. And I knew that, like, if I left, I would regret it. You know, I was going, like, thinking, like, in the future, if I asked my daughter, like, would you have wanted me to stay or would you have wanted me to go? And I know that my daughter would have been like, I would have wanted you to stay. So there was a lot happening at our raid too. You know, I felt the ancestors with me. Like, I was, you know, obviously not in conversation with the RCMP, but yelling at them, telling them that they're the ones who are killers. They're the ones who are criminals. We are not criminals. We're not armed. We haven't killed anyone. We haven't stolen any children. We haven't stolen any lands or resources. So who's the criminal? And so I'm like, we're here because of your kin and your grandchildren too as well. I held that feather, and it's what kept me grounded. And we helicopters came flying in. They dropped TAC teams and canine units and bomb squads, and we made our stand on the bus. So as they were coming from both ends, me and my partner went on the bus, and we had two fellow Indigenous kin up on top of the bus on a platform, Anne and Denzel. And so, you know, we tried to hold as long as we could. I know that I wasn't able to make a stronger stand because I was pregnant. So when they finally figured out that they could just open the door, because we didn't lock it, we effing forgot about that. Anyway, so they finally figured out how to open the door. And then they came in, and, you know, they did read us the injunction. They're like, do you comply? And we were just like, we're silent. And they came in the bus, and my partner got up to try to protect me, but he was like, he can't make a move because, you know, they're going to hurt us. So then they came to me, and they're like, you know, leave. I didn't say anything. As soon as RCMP touched my elbow, I'm like, okay. I got up, and, like, I can't, you know, be tasered. I can't be kicked. So I left, and I was, torn off my territory. And what came to mind was genocide.
That was Brent Patterson in conversation with Eve Saint. You can listen to the full interview with Eve and her sister Jossie Alec in our December 10th episode. It's an incredibly powerful listen, and we so appreciate the two sisters taking the time to speak with us. And thank you to Brent Patterson for keeping such a detailed eye, especially during the last few months when the police raided the Gidimden checkpoint camp, where land defenders were blockading the main forest road so that pipeline developers could not get through. You can be sure we'll be following this story into the new year, because as Eve Saint said in that interview, this is far from over. Switching gears now from environmental news to the world of the internet. This year saw Facebook become engulfed in controversy once again. That's not necessarily unique to 2021, but it did ultimately rebrand itself. In October, Mark Zuckerberg announced that Facebook was to be rebranded as Meta. However, critics believed that the renaming was just a distraction from the controversies the social media conglomerate had found itself embroiled in. Canadians began to wonder, what will the government do to implement regulations for social media giants like Facebook? To break down this question and all things regarding policy and Facebook, which also owns Instagram and WhatsApp, our national politics reporter Stephen Wenzel sat down with Dr. Michael Geist back in October. Geist is a law professor at the University of Ottawa, where he holds the Canada Research Chair in Internet and E-commerce Law. He's also the author of the 2015 book Law, Privacy, and Surveillance in Canada in the Post-Snowden era. Here's a piece of that interview.
In the last couple of weeks, Facebook's been back in the limelight after the whistleblowers came forward, both on 60 Minutes and recently on CNN. I'm wondering what your takeaways were from their insights into the operations within Facebook.
Well, I mean, I think a lot of people are understandably deeply troubled by by what we've seen come out and the reports of what that company's engaged in. I don't know that a ton of it is a total shock. I think there's been a fair amount of reporting and a sense that this has been taking place for some time. I think it does reemphasize the need to ensure that to develop laws that are effective, and to think even more about the enforcement challenge that we face. Not you raised the jurisdictional one or geographic one of how does a somewhat smaller country, you know, ensure that its rules are respected. I think we're in an environment where you can make the case that even the largest players are finding that their rules aren't necessarily respected, or that they're finding it a challenge, right? You know, and, you know, if we reach the point that huge penalties are still just viewed as a cost of doing business, then we're going to have to re-examine the sorts of penalties that are associated with some of these rules. I also think, and again, it comes back to addressing structural challenges as opposed to symptoms. You know, I think the emphasis that we've seen, that we saw from Frances Haugen, for example, has really been on things like transparency and accountability. And, you know, we need more transparency around algorithmic choices. The argument being that Facebook's incentives for those algorithms are largely commercial without much regard for some of the broader implications that they may have. And that we need that kind of transparency to at least understand that and then be in a better position to take action. I do think it's a concern that the proposals we've seen so far from the Canadian government don't move in that direction. They're content largely to treat these companies either as an ATM, so that they want look at these companies as a potential revenue source for policies and programs, as opposed to, you know, potentially activities or actions that are better constrained. So either it's viewing them as a source of cash, or it's seeking largely to regulate the content on these sites. I think that too is a mistake. Haugen is really pointing us in the right direction, which is to focus more on transparency and accountability with these companies, as opposed to the mess that I think we've seen so far from the Canadian government, whether that's looking at these companies from a broadcast perspective, from a media perspective, or from an online harms perspective.
That was Stephen Wenzel's interview with Dr. Michael Geist from our What to Do About Facebook episode this past fall. Thanks for that, Stephen and Dr. Geist. This year also saw a snap election, of course, the result being Trudeau was re-elected for a third term as Prime Minister with his second minority government, though the Liberals were no doubt hoping to win a majority when Trudeau called the election back in August. The results were for the most part unchanged from the 2019 Canadian federal election. Having said that, there was much news to be made out of the election and the actions that Trudeau has taken since then. Keeping rabble informed and up to date on everything going on at Parliament Hill was our very own senior politics reporter, Carl Nirenberg. On the site, Carl brought us stories every week detailing how decisions made at Parliament would affect Canadians. In October, Carl joined me on the podcast to discuss Trudeau's cabinet shuffle and suggest why, at 39 members, the cabinet is as big as it is this time around. Take a listen.
Why do you think this cabinet is the size that it is this time? Is this a deviation for Justin Trudeau to have such a large cabinet? And in a minority government, does that play into his decision to go bigger?
Traditionally, lots of cabinets have been large in Canada. It was at one point an effort to really reduce the size of cabinet and make it efficient and focused. But that's sort of the exception, especially in more recent, let's say, the last half century. The big problem is that we, the public, think of the minister as being in charge of a department of government and in charge of activities of government. So if we just needed those people to sort of be the top person for the foreign affairs or global affairs and the health department and other similar departments, there would be many fewer ministers. You know, there are more ministers than there are departments. And the reason is that Trudeau, like other prime ministers, fulfills other political needs in appointing cabinet members. It's an old tradition that we have to use the cabinet to get representation at the center of government from as many parts of the country as possible. So you have to have at least a minister from every province, assuming you have members from every province. I mean, the current Liberals only have 2 members from Alberta and 0 from Saskatchewan, but one of those 2 members is in the cabinet. Not a senior job, but he's in the cabinet. They actually have all 4 members from Prince Edward Island, but the entire population of Prince Edward Island is about the size of 1 riding in Ontario. And yet they always get a cabinet minister. If you have members, they'll always find somebody to put in the cabinet there. Newfoundland, there's altogether 7 members. And again, the ridings in Newfoundland are much smaller than they are in a place like Ontario. Still, they get 2 cabinet ministers. And it's just what we used to call pork barrel. It's kind of almost like a patronage, like where the people from certain regions will feel better if they see, oh, we have some big shot from our region is right in the center of government. And so you have to fulfill that purpose as well, a prime minister, to keep people loyal to him who want to dangle this opportunity. Like every member of parliament, that's what they really want to be. A cabinet minister earns way, way more money than a member of parliament. So let's be very simple about it. The other thing is he gets a driver and a chauffeur and a great big office, and he gets flown around the world on business class flights everywhere. You know, a simple member of parliament is a little schlepper. He's just a nobody. But Justin Trudeau's father said, when they're 50 meters from Parliament Hill, they're nobodies. Well, the cabinet minister is not a nobody. He's a big cheese. So everybody wants to be a big shot. So to reward loyalty, to reward good behavior and make the others think, I better be loyal so I can get rewarded too, the prime minister gives his pals and his friends and people who he thinks are loyal jobs in the cabinet. So the whole thing expands.
That was Carl Nirenberg from our October 29th episode, when we discussed Trudeau's unveiling of his 2021 cabinet. This month, our Off the Hill political panel delved into Justin Trudeau's government once again, this time dissecting the speech from the throne. To break it down, hosts Libby Davies and Robin Brown prompted our panelists Carl Nirenberg, poet and scholar Elle Jones, MP Leah Gazan, and Indigenous activist and writer Clayton Thomas Mueller. Our esteemed guests discussed what was said during the speech, what was absent, and what it all meant for activists. Take a listen to the full panel to hear a brilliant exchange between Elle Jones and Leah Gazan. Our panelists were in agreement that while pretty words about Indigenous reconciliation, solving climate change, and keeping Canadians safe and healthy through the pandemic were said, the speech was actually devoid of real substance. MP Leah Gazan speaks in this clip from the panel.
I think it was missing a lot of things, including things that certainly the NDP had pushed for, a wealth tax, you know, something that is really critical. Who's going to pay for the pandemic? Well, we know who now. You know, currently there are seniors in my riding being cut off GIS because they're utilizing the CRB and CERB income as part of income. They're now losing their GIS. The same thing is happening to families who are getting cut off the child tax benefit. And it seems like people continue to pay for it while this government continues to invest in pipelines, you know, invest in fighter jets, you know, where they're looking at, you know, investing in warships. Meanwhile, people are really struggling. Inflation is growing. We know that. But the cost of the inflation cannot be on the backs of the people and our environment.
Yeah. And were you surprised, Leah, that there was so little of substance in terms of the climate emergency? Like there was no reference really to COP26, to what the government plans to do. I mean, it was really quite vacuous.
Well, I actually wasn't surprised. And actually, we are doing, you know, doing the worst out of, you know, all G7 countries. I mean, we have shown where our priorities are, you know, TMX pipeline, LNG, all of this investment in fossil fuels, little or no investment in a just transition. Workers are not doing well. There is no discussions about things like a JLBI, a guaranteed livable basic income, to assist people in even having the choice to support and move out of a just transition. I think it's the same old, and without being hyper-partisan, I think our, you know, all parties have to be on board with bold climate action. We are in a climate crisis. We see that out in BC right now. We see that out east. We need, I'm disappointed that we don't have a budget that shows a clear commitment to taking bold actions against the climate emergency and taking bold actions to make sure that people can thrive, not just survive, and that life doesn't get harder for families and individuals in Canada.
Once again, that was Leah Gazan, just one of our honored guests on our latest Off the Hill panel, Games of the Throne. I highly suggest you check out the full version on rabble.ca/rabbleTV. It was a fiery panel. What a great way to wrap up the year for our monthly political panel series. And I'm sure that they will only get better in the new year. Those were our top stories on Rabble Radio this year. Now let's take a look at the top stories of the week on rabble.ca in a segment called In Case You Missed It. This week at Rabble, the Omicron variant appears to be taking hold around the globe and in various Canadian cities. Have we actually learned anything from the last 2 years? Are our governments capable of providing support for societies most vulnerable to the virus? Are we making any progress on improving indoor air quality in communal spaces like schools to combat an airborne virus? And are travel restrictions making any sort of difference? As Nora Loretto, author of the newly released book Spin Doctors, How Media and Politicians Misdiagnosed the COVID-19 Pandemic, says, it feels like Groundhog Day. You know, the Bill Murray kind. Here we go again. I reviewed Nora's book on the site this week. It's an insightful, compelling, and you've been warned, it is a depressing read about the government and media failure that in many ways paved the way for COVID-19 to wreak the havoc that it has. Nora takes readers through the first 18 months of this pandemic, from January 2020 through the end of June 2021. As we well know by now, the pandemic doesn't end then, and we are still grappling with many of the same challenges we faced 1 year ago. However, as Nora proves, at this point, we ought to know better. That's why in Carl Nirenberg's analysis of Finance Minister Chrystia Freeland's fall economic update, he wonders why there isn't more money being dedicated to improving indoor air quality for Canadians. There is indeed a section of the update most overlooked on clean and healthy indoor air. The Finance Minister's update includes a small business refundable tax credit of up to $10,000 per location and $50,000 per business organization, which businesses can receive for eligible global air quality improvement expenses. And there is, in addition, $100 million for provinces and territories for improvements to ventilation in schools, an additional $70 to $100 million available, the government announced a year ago, to support ventilation projects in public and community buildings, such as hospitals, libraries, and community centers. It's something, but it's not much, writes Nirenberg, considering the degree to which stopping the spread of this virus entails getting it out of the air we breathe, particularly going into another long winter as we are. Speaking of lessons unlearned, over in Alberta, where Premier Jason Kenney infamously declared the pandemic over last summer, the government is loosening COVID-19 restrictions for the holiday season, David Kleiman-Haga reports. Groundhog Day indeed. Also this week on Rabble.ca, in case you missed it, 34 people's names were commemorated at this month's Toronto Monthly Homeless Memorial on December 14th. Of those 34 names, 19 people died inside city shelters in the month of October, writes street nurse Kathy Crow in her monthly column. In response, the Shelter Housing Justice Network is demanding that Toronto City Council must immediately strike a task force charged with taking all reasonable steps to reduce such deaths, but also take measures to ensure safe shelter, an expansion of housing allowances, harm reduction measures, and to stop encampment evictions. In case you missed it, Stephen Wenzel spoke to activists about the federal government's new bill to remove some mandatory minimum sentences from the criminal code. Toronto journalist, activist, and author Desmond Cole panned the bill as deeply cynical and an incomplete policy, as he calls for all mandatory minimum sentences to be dropped, including those for crimes involving gangs, and for life sentences to end. Quote, "I just think the government needs to spare us all of the rhetoric about race when the sentences that they are keeping up will also continue to disproportionately put Black and Indigenous people in jail," Cole told Rabble.ca. Justice Minister David Lametti said the government will continue to address the social determinants of crime and marked the bill as an important step in that direction. And with that, that is our show this week and for this year. Rabble Radio is taking a few weeks off for the holiday season, although the writers and contributors at Rabble.ca will continue to bring you up-to-date news throughout the month, so keep your eyes out for that. If you liked what you heard on this week's show, please consider subscribing wherever you listen to your podcasts. Rate, review, share it with your friends. It only takes 2 seconds to support independent media like Rabble, but it means the world to us. Follow us on social media across channels at RabbleCA. And if you have feedback for the show, get in touch anytime at editor@rabble.ca. I'm your host, Chelsea Nash. On behalf of everyone here at Rabble, we want to thank you for tuning in and supporting our show. And we also want to wish you a safe and happy new year. Thanks to our podcast producer, Brianne Doyle, to Carl Nirenberg for the music, and all the journalists and writers who contributed to this year's content on Rabble Radio, Off the Hill, and Rabble.ca. We'll see you around the site.